The bills are set down for second reading and the financial stability report is set down for consideration. The clerk has been informed of the introduction of bills.
New Zealand Public Health and Disability Amendment Bill, introduction. Ahuriri Hapu Claims Settlement Bill, introduction. Arms, Firearms Prohibition Orders Amendment Bill No. 2, introduction.
Now, those bills are set down for first reading. The House comes to oral questions. Question number one is in the name of the Honourable Paula Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Prime Minister. Does she stand by all her government's statements and actions regarding gangs?
The Right Honourable Winston Peters.
On behalf of the Prime Minister, yes.
Why are there 1,600 extra patched gang members on our streets since her government took office?
Can I just say that one of those is because of the deportation policies from Australia. The other is the environment that was allowed to grow that ensures that gangs do thrive in this country under the previous administration. And the third one is the gangs have not got it through their heads that this government means to deal to that sort of behaviour. Because they're used to a party saying, the day after election we'll bulldoze the headquarters down. They said that and did nothing about it.
How many of the 20,000 extra victims last year were victims of gang crime?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, that is not known. As to whether it was a partial association, a full association, an intermediary association, an historical association, that sort of information we don't have. But what we do have, and very shortly, is not 1,000 or 1,500, but 2,000 new frontline police being deployed to take on this area. That means boots on the ground, not dinosaur footprints.
How many of the more than 51,000 victims of burglaries and almost 18,000 victims of serious assault were victims due to the actions of gangs?
Could I say that, Member, she can make out that sort of construction as though it's somehow a new feature of our society when we know that under her administration, 90% plus of such crimes were not solved. We've got the frontline police to ensure today they are, and that's why we've gone way beyond our commitment for 1,800 new frontline police. We have given a commitment to go to 2,000 by March of this year. That's the greatest number ever, and 700 of them are going to be consigned to taking on the gangs in this country.
Is her government's greatest achievement increasing the number of patched gang members by 1,594?
Again, holding up a chart like that, which is actually rather sad, because what that chart represented yesterday was the highest house building rate in this country since 1973. This fantastic news that should be celebrated has been like the number one lemon suckers in the country turned around now to a chart about gangs. The problem is that we have got ourselves ready to deal to the gangs in this country. We've changed the laws, and there are laws we are changing with respect to the use of guns, which, dare I say it, is being supported over here, but not by them. So let's have a little less of the crocodile tears and a bit of on-the-ground common sense.
Does she agree with the Tauranga Mayor who said, quote, countries who are soft on crime tend to have crime escalate following the double gang shooting in Tauranga?
But I say again, Tenby Powell had a call from the Minister of Police this morning. That's the first thing. The second thing is he has been assured of the number of people we are putting on the ground and that the police will be provisioned with the utilities to do their job. The third thing is, that quote could have been said by me. It sounds so original.
Well, is she satisfied with the response from New Zealand Police that they can't do much and they can't arrest their way out of increased gang violence?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, the police in this country may have had that sentiment one time, but now there'll be no excuse because they will have the resources, they'll have the men and women in the front power and on the front line, and in contrast, we saw the previous administration run the police numbers down, not going up, going down. And if I had that record, I'd keep my mouth shut.
The Honourable Stuart Nash.
Has she seen a report from Jared Gilbert that stated when Australian gangs became established in New Zealand in 2011, the next year police numbers fell by 150?
I want to thank the Minister of Police for reminding us of the fact, not just allegations. But can I just say, police will be on the ground. Expect to see more armed police on the streets of Hawke's Bay and the Bay of Plenty in response to this gang tension. Expect to see police openly carrying their rifles and pistols where it's required. Expect to see police wearing new body armour. Expect to see the Eagle or helicopter in the air. And expect to see police executing search warrants at gang properties. And expect them also to be enforcing the new laws that we are about to pass with respect to their gang access or the provisioning of gangs with guns, which that opposition party there is opposing.
The Honourable Stuart Nash.
Has she seen reports in the last 5 years of the previous government police numbers actually fell?
No. Oh, really? No, no. That's not an area that the Prime Minister is responsible for. Question number two, Willow Jean Prime.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Finance. What recent reports has he seen on the New Zealand economy?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Grant Robertson.
Mr. Speaker, yesterday the Reserve Bank released its latest monetary policy statement. The bank forecasts New Zealand's GDP growth to remain slightly subdued at the beginning of this year before picking up again to be at 3.4% in the year to March 2021, supported by low interest rates and the government's infrastructure investments. There's good news there for workers as well, Mr. Speaker. The Reserve Bank sees employment currently at around its maximum sustainable level, while according to its forecast it will remain at around 4% over the next 4 years, and wage growth is also expected to remain strong.
Supplementary. What did the monetary policy statement say about risks to New Zealand's economic growth?
Mr. Speaker, the bank highlighted that global growth has been acting as a headwind to economic momentum through elevated uncertainty, rising trade barriers and slower global manufacturing. The Reserve Bank said that despite some tentative signs of easing of trade tensions, including the signing of the US-China Phase 1 trade deal, downside risk remains, including specifically the COVID-19 outbreak. The bank's current projections assume the effects of the outbreak on New Zealand's growth to be short-lived, but they stress that any economic implications remain very uncertain at this stage.
Supplementary. What is the government doing to ensure the New Zealand economy is resilient to these risks?
Well, Mr. Speaker, overall, the government's economic plan will ensure we are adaptable and resilient by transitioning to being more productive, sustainable and inclusive in our economic growth. Obviously, the recent $12 billion New Zealand upgrade program is a critical part of that plan to future-proof our infrastructure, create jobs and provide certainty. With regard to the COVID-19 outbreak, as the Reserve Bank said, it remains early days. The government is actively monitoring the situation, working closely with industries and supporting ministers to provide advice on how we may respond to future developments. There is no doubt that there will be an immediate impact on New Zealand's first quarter GDP as a result, particularly of the impact on tourism.
Question number three, the Honourable Paul Goldsmith.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Finance. Does he stand by all his policies and statements?
Mr. Speaker. Yes, in the context in which they were made and given, and in particular I stand by my comment yesterday that we're getting on with the business of government, we're positive about the future of New Zealand, and we're focused on the issues that matter to New Zealanders.
How can he stand by his statement from October last year that, quote, the New Zealand economy is in good shape, close quotes, when just yesterday the Reserve Bank lowered its annual GDP growth estimate for 2019 to just 1.6%.
Mr. Speaker, in answer to the first part of that question, I can say that, Mr. Speaker, because New Zealand's growth rates continue to outperform those of many advanced economies. We have unemployment at historically low levels of 4%. We have debt for the Crown at historically low levels as well. We've run surpluses. We're spending money in the parts of the economy that will stimulate jobs and growth. So, Mr. Speaker, I can say with confidence that the New Zealand economy is in good shape.
So does 1.6% growth in 2019 mean that per person we didn't grow at all last year?
Mr. Speaker, again, the member is using a figure that includes a projection for the December quarter. We'll wait and see where that ends up. What I do know is on the official figures that we have that New Zealand's growth continues to outperform most advanced economies.
Well, how can we afford higher wages, better healthcare, better public services when the economy is not keeping up with population growth?
Mr. Speaker, again, the same question. I think the member has got assumptions in his question that are not yet proven. What I would say is that the economy is sustaining that in a period in which we had around 2.7% growth. We also saw wages increase by around 3.5%. That's catch-up, I might here add, Mr. Speaker, on 10 years where New Zealanders saw very few benefits of economic growth under this government they are.
Well, does he agree that ultimately higher wages are not sustainable if the economy is not keeping up with population growth, as it didn't in 2019?
Well, Mr. Speaker, what I do know is that higher wages for New Zealanders, the benefit of their hard work and their dividend from the prosperity of New Zealand. Of course, we need the economy to continue to grow at sustainable rates. And as I said, we continue to grow at a faster rate than many of our trading partners. This is a time to be positive about the economy, not just normal negative national.
Does he accept that families will ultimately be less financially secure if the economy is not keeping up with population growth, as it didn't in 2019?
Mr. Speaker, it's been a goal of this government from the day we entered here to make families more secure. It's the very reason why we put in place a families package with $5.5 billion to lift the incomes of low and middle-income New Zealanders. It's why we're pleased that we are seeing the wage growth that we're seeing. We always aim for solid, sustainable growth, and in New Zealand we can say we are ahead of the curve internationally, but I am proud of a government that is delivering a dividend to working New Zealanders through wage growth.
The Right Honourable Winston Peters.
If the economy keeping up with population growth was the concern, does the member have any comparison between 18, 19 and this year compared to the years 14, 15, 16 and 17 when we had all-comers records coming into this country?
Mr. Speaker, I don't have the exact figures to hand for that. What I can say for sure is that in those years, we saw net migration at record high levels. And it would be fair to say at that time, one of the things a responsible government might have been doing was actually building the infrastructure that was needed to support that kind of population growth. We saw none of that. That's why the New Zealand Upgrade Programme is so important.
Order. There is a limit to the free hits from a supplementary.
How is it possible that a country with historically high export prices and a government able to increase spending significantly can stall like New Zealand did in 2019?
Mr. Speaker, I reject the premise of that question.
It's not an Australian reject. Question number four, the Honourable Dr. Nick Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Justice. Does the government support the statement by the Electoral Commission that, quote, the New Zealand First Foundation has received donations which should have been treated as party donations for the New Zealand First Party, and that, quote, the donations were not properly transmitted to the party and not disclosed as required by the Electoral Act 1993.
The Honourable Andrew Little.
Mr. Speaker, I refer the member to Section 6 of the Electoral Act 1993, which states that the Electoral Commission may, if it considers that it is necessary for the proper discharge of its functions, make any inquiries. And I also refer the member to Section 7 of that Act, which states that the Electoral Commission must act independently in performing its statutory functions and duties and exercising its statutory powers. So, to answer the member's question, it is irrelevant whether the government supports the Electoral Commission in any particular action. The Electoral Commission is independent of the government, and that is as it should be.
Supplementary. Does he agree with the Deputy Prime Minister's criticism of the Electoral Commission when he said, quote, this is a very damning statement for the Electoral Commission because they have no evidence or proof for their statement? And does the full government retain confidence in the Electoral Commission?
Mr Speaker, in relation to the second part of the question, yes.
Does he agree with yesterday's statement by the Deputy Prime Minister that the major donors to the New Zealand First Foundation are entitled to keep their identities secret? And is this statement consistent with government electoral policy?
A point of order, the Right Honourable
Mr Speaker, will have occurred to you by now that the Minister being asked these questions is not responsible for the base on which the question is being put in the first place. That would be obvious to any experienced Member of Parliament. And the second thing is, this matter, in the interests of honesty and openness and candour, is being a subject of investigation, which we welcome. But for somebody to come here, sir, and make this argument out, who told Parliament that he had made a declaration to the Parliamentary Commissioner, who then wrote to me and said, no, he has not, is a matter of grave audacity. He should be able to use this Parliament in that way. He can't substantiate what he's doing with respect to the Minister's responsibility, and he should be stopped in his tracks.
Speaking to the Court of Order, the Honourable Dr Nixon.
Mr Speaker, it's a long-established practice that you can ask the Minister to comment on colleagues' comments, and secondly, that it's within the Minister's portfolio responsibilities of electoral law, and whether the Minister agrees with his colleague on that.
I'm going to ask the Member to rephrase his question. I'm surprised it wasn't an objection on another ground. I think the Leader of the New Zealand First Party might have made a comment. I don't think the Deputy Prime Minister did. So if the Member rephrases his question to get it appropriate, then he can ask it again.
Does he...
A point of order... the Honourable Gerry Brownie.
Mr Speaker, we get again into the difficulty that this Parliament's faced on a number of occasions, where you have the various hats being pulled on and off by people. But the convention is that a minister is always a minister. He can't be a part-time member of the government. And so when the Right Honourable Winston Peters was speaking yesterday, unless he introduced himself as in another role and made it very clear, then everyone has a right to assume he speaks as Deputy Prime Minister, Minister in the Government.
Speaking to the Court of the Right Honourable Winston Peters.
I think I can help you there. The press statement I put out was put out as Leader of New Zealand First, not as a Minister, not as a Deputy Prime Minister, but in the name of the Office of the Leader of New Zealand First, the Parliamentary Wing. And that, sir, is the precise answer. It went out on Sunday at 2 o'clock, last Sunday, and that's my authority for what I'm asking to.
The Honourable Chris Hopkins.
Mr Speaker, this is very well-traversed ground in this House. In fact, when the former Prime Minister John Key was questioned about similar matters, party matters, he was often quoted in the media as Prime Minister John Key, and he made it clear in the House that he had been commenting as Leader of the National Party, and the House accepted that, and the then opposition was prevented from asking him further questions about it.
Yes, and I'm not preventing the member from asking his question, because it is within order to ask a minister if he agrees with a statement, if it's in their general area of responsibility, and if it's not, the minister can say so. But in this particular case, it is clear to me that there is nothing in the area of the Deputy Prime Minister's responsibilities that is being addressed by this. The Honourable Dr Nick Smith, rephrasing the question.
Certainly, Mr Speaker. Does he agree with yesterday's statement by Winston Peters that the major donors to the New Zealand First Foundation are entitled to keep their identities secret, and is this statement consistent with government electoral policy?
Mr Speaker, the statement is consistent with the Electoral Act, which allows, within its framework, for donations up to a certain threshold to be made and the donor to be concealed.
Does he share the concerns of commentators and political scientists that the large undisclosed donations from the racing industry to New Zealand First, alongside millions of dollars of concessions by this government in its 2018 and 2019 budget, raise serious probity questions about New Zealand's electoral system?
Mr Speaker, look, throughout the last many years, there have been donations of of all sorts of origins made to all sorts of MPs. I recall a donation from a Labour hire company being made to the Honourable Simon Bridges, and he subsequently became Minister for Workplace Relations. So I think we have a level of transparency in our current Electoral Act. The question for this House will be and must be whether that Act, much of what, the drafting of which goes back to 1956, is fit for purpose in the 21st century, and this side of the House is keen to see a ground-up review for that legislation that will bring it into the 21st century.
Supplementary, is he concerned that... Is he concerned that the party that determined the final outcome of the 2017 election breached as many as seven sections of the Electoral Act, notably Section...
A point of order. The member sits when someone calls a point of order.
Mr Speaker, this is a serious offence to the running of this House when a member gets up and thinks he can mouth those allegations without any response. The first thing we have, sir, in this country, and it's a proud matter of law, is that you're innocent until proven guilty. The second thing is there is...
Order. Member will resume his seat. Points of order will be heard in silence, and the indication which I gave very recently is reversed. The Right Honourable Winston Peters.
Sir, he's about to listen. He began with the first one. Again, he has got no right or sanctuary in this House to make those statements when they're not backed up with one fact whatsoever. We are happy to wait upon an external inquiry as set up by the lawful authorities of this country. But what we won't do is have someone think and get away with making all sorts of libelous allegations in this House and get away with it.
All right. I'm not going to hear from anyone further on this. What I am going to do is I am going to allow Dr. Smith to get a little further into his question and work out from that for myself whether he is making an unfounded allegation or whether he has in very short terms the evidence. And I'll remind him that questions have two legs and they don't have seven.
Point of order, Mr. Speaker. I seek leave of the House to table the statement by the New Zealand Electoral Commission saying that the New Zealand First Party breached the Electoral Act 1993.
Well, it's been well published. I don't know why the member's seeking the leave for that.
Members are disputing whether there's evidence they broke the law.
Member will resume a seat. The member may have a further supplementary now if he wants one.
Supplementary. Is the minister concerned that the party that determined the final outcome of election 2017 has breached as many as seven sections of the Electoral Act?
Right. No. I'm going to rule that one out. It's all right.
Did he, as minister, have any discussions with Labor colleagues on the Justice Select Committee regarding the request of the former New Zealand First President and Treasurer to give evidence in the 2017 election inquiry that saw them ultimately block that request?
Mr. Speaker, no.
Supplementary. Does the Minister share the concerns of Dr. Andrew Geddes of Otago University that the breaches of the Electoral Act as determined?
Point of order, the Right Honourable Winston.
Mr. Speaker, now he's about to quote from someone who claims to be a lecturer or professor of law who seems not to understand, even though he has an office down at that university, the first principle of our law, which is you are innocent until proven guilty. And if I was to challenge Mr. Geddes to give me the legal opinion and the authority in which he makes his statement,
Prime Minister will resume his seat, and Mr. Bishop just lost the, as a result of his interjection, lost the additional question which the National Party had just got. I want to hear the end of the question.
My supplementary, does the Minister share the concerns of Dr. Andrew Geddes of Otago University's Political Science Department, who says that the systematic use of the New Zealand First Foundation for the purposes of avoiding the electoral law amounts to the most serious breach of New Zealand's electoral law.
Mr. Speaker, I'm aware of a number of concerns that Professor Andrew Geddes has raised by some parties under our Electoral Act, including actions by the National Party funnelling donations to electorate candidates through their party, including to Nick Smith, whose only declared donation in the 2017 election was a $25,000 donation from the National Party. What was he trying to conceal?
Question number five, Derek Ball.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Order, the pair of you. Two most experienced members of, or two of the three most experienced members of the House should know better.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Defence. What recent reports has he received of the New Zealand Defence Force delivering value to the community or world?
Mr. Speaker. Honourable Ron Mark.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, I can assure the House that while Parliament was in recess over the summer break, our women and our men in uniform have been very busy. In the community last week, an NH90 helicopter with 11 personnel, two Unimog trucks, 13 soldiers deployed to Southland to help people trapped by flooding. As part of the government response to the novel coronavirus outbreak, the Tamaki Leadership Centre in Whangaparoa, with support of New Zealand Defence Force personnel, has been used as accommodation facility for those in isolation after being evacuated from China. And many of you would have seen the brilliant Tri-Service Guard, Tri-Service Kapa Haka Group, the Black Falcons Flypass, the Army Chefs, the military bands, HMNZS Waitangi, all at Waitangi this year, supporting a range of events, including the opening of Te Rau Aroha, the Māori Armed Forces Museum.
Supplementary to the Minister, is the Minister aware of any recent examples where NZDF has delivered value on the world stage?
Mr. Speaker, alongside our maintaining deployments to diverse theatres such as Afghanistan, Egypt, Iraq, the Korean Peninsula and South Sudan this summer, the New Zealand Defence Force lent forward with our Australian and Pacific partners in a huge effort to support the response to the Australian bushfires. In total, 147 personnel have deployed to Australia, including military firefighters, the New Zealand combat engineers, plant operators, environmental health personnel, primary health teams, as well as three NH90 helicopters, two C-130 Hercules and one B-757.
Okay, further supplementary.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. What challenges arose for helicopter crews on the mission to support the Australian bushfire response?
Well, Mr. Speaker, it's a good question because conditions for the helicopter crews were extremely challenging at times, with severe turbulence, dense smoke, dust storms and electrical storms affecting flying conditions. Despite this, however, the crews and maintainers performed exceptionally, and with exception of days when smoke and weather prevented flying, 100% of all missions allocated were flown. It is noteworthy that there was little to no respite between the return to New Zealand and redeployment of an NH90 and crew down to Southland in response to the flooding down there.
Supplementary, what challenges arose for C-130 crews on the mission to support the Australian bushfire response?
Yeah, Mr. Speaker, once again, unfortunately, one of the C-130s first arrived in the first C-130 arrived in Australia to contribute to the response, it broke down. A second C-130 had to be sent over along with a new engine before joining the ADF firefighting effort. Once again, Mr. Speaker, this reinforces the challenge of operating with ageing defence equipment and a problem we have inherited here. I'm proud of the Coalition Government for making the decision last year to select the highly capable C-130 J-30 Super Hercules as a replacement for these old and ageing 1960s era Hercules. Rest assured, Mr. Speaker, and the House, that front of my mind is progressing the procurement of the Super Hercules. It is our highest capability priority this year that this Government will address.
Very good.
Question number six, the Honourable Michael Woodhouse.
My question is to the Minister of Health. Are the same 2019 novel coronavirus screening processes in place for all flights from China as announced on 26 January 2020, also in place at airports and ports that receive passengers from affected areas that have not arrived directly from China?
The Honourable Julianne Ginter.
On behalf of the Minister, health staff are meeting all direct flights from China and can meet any international passenger regardless of where their flight originates. No one other than New Zealand citizens or permanent residents who has been in China since travel restrictions were introduced is currently being allowed into New Zealand. And anyone on any flight who is identified at the airport, and passports are all being checked, as having been in mainland China from midnight on the 2nd of February that isn't on a direct flight from mainland China will be treated exactly the same as people who arrive on direct flights.
Are there health staff meeting all ships and flights with passengers arriving from outbreak areas? And if not, why did she effectively answer yes to that in the primary question?
Mr. Speaker, the answer might be a little bit longer. There is a complex set of arrangements in place that identifies that anyone who's been in the affected area will be met by public health staff, yes.
Well, does he agree that if health staff are available at Auckland and Christchurch airports and not available at any other port or airport in New Zealand, then those screening processes are clearly not the same?
What the member might not appreciate is that the only flights coming into airports outside of Auckland and Christchurch are coming through Australia, and Australia has the same checks in place as New Zealand. There are outside of Auckland, Wellington and Christchurch, the only commercial flights that I'm aware of arriving at airports in New Zealand have been through Australia, where they have the exact same screening processes and, in fact, are not allowing New Zealand citizens or residents who are not normally resident on Australia to transit.
What does she say to traveller Harry Flett, who said of the screening process, quote, you could have said you were feeling fine but have a raging fever and they would have let you through, end quote.
With all due respect to anecdotes that are being reported in the media, I don't think that they paint the full picture. Clearly that person did not have a raging fever and so is speculating.
Does he believe the reason health officials now have to track down 4,000 people who haven't registered with the coronavirus health line is because none of the written material available at airports actually ask them to?
Mr. Speaker, I am confident that health officials are acting under the best advice. We are reviewing our border response in light of the best evidence, science and medical advice in a rapidly evolving situation.
Has he received any advice from his associate, Minister Julianne Ginter, on how to manage the outbreak based on her experience with the measles outbreak last year?
Mr. Speaker, I can assure the member that the Health Minister works very closely with his associate ministers, and we're very proud of the fact that we're finally launching the catch-up campaign that the previous government never did to finally address under-immunisation with respect to measles.
Question number 7, the Honourable Louise Upson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Social Development and asks, does she stand by her statement, and I quote, if that member ever asks me a question again in this House about a thing called the dole, which does not exist, I will refuse to answer the question, unquote.
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Carmel Cipollone.
Yes. What I have been attempting to convey is that her questions about a thing called the dole are unclear and ambiguous. The Ministry of Social
Order.
The Ministry...
I just want to say there's an important point of principle. Sorry, who interjected then? Sorry? Oh, okay, all right. There's a serious point of principle that both the questioner and the minister are attempting to establish as a result of this question. And I think it's important that we listen, and it ill behoves people who shout down either the minister or the questioner.
Again, Mr. Speaker?
Yes.
Okay. Yes, what I have been attempting to convey is that her questions about a thing called the dole are unclear and ambiguous. The Ministry of Social Development does not have any products or services referred to as the dole. There is also no reference to the word in social security legislation. I feel it's in the public interest that the correct terminology for government support and assistance is used during question time. And on that point, some actual examples of main benefits in New Zealand include job seeker support, sole parent support and supported living payment, youth payment, young parent payment and emergency benefit.
Supplementary question. Is she in denial about the fact that the government has put an additional 27,000 people onto the dole? And in fact, a larger percentage of people coming back onto the dole within 13 weeks of leaving than under National.
Mr Speaker, there is no such thing as the dole in the social security legislation, and there are no Ministry of Social Development products referred to or called the dole.
Supplementary.
Before the member asks the question, I am going to assume, if the Minister has shouted down again, that National Party members do not want to have any further supplementaries. Louise Upston.
When will she advise the Prime Minister about her statement about the dole being unclear and unambiguous, because that's how the Prime Minister has referred to it in this House?
Mr Speaker, I am referring to the use of terminology during question time. And as the Minister for Social Development, I think it is in the public's interest that we use correct terminology when referring to services and supports that the Ministry of Social Development provides.
Supplementary question. Why, if she's not willing to correct the Prime Minister on the 21st of May last year when she referred to people in mana and mahi who get the equivalent of the dole in this House, and yet refuse me as a member of the opposition when holding her to account for the additional 27,000 people who are on the dole?
Mr Speaker, as the Minister for Social Development, I think it's important that we use the correct terminology when referring to the supports and assistance that are available through the Ministry for Social Development. And I think, as the Minister for Social Development, it is important during question time, a very formal part of the process here in Parliament, that we do use the correct terminology and that it is in the best interest of the public to do so.
Supplementary. When will she correct the Prime Minister, who continues to use it, including on Facebook posts?
Mr Speaker, I keep referring to question time as the process where I think it's important to use the correct terminology with respect to Ministry of Social Development supports and assistance, and I stand by that statement, Mr Speaker.
Supplementary. Does she believe people are better off having the opportunity to earn their own income through work, or is she happy for them to live hand to mouth on the dole?
Mr Speaker, there is no such type of assistance referred to in the social security legislation or by the Ministry of Social Development called the dole. If the member would like to put questions down that refer to actual types of benefits that are paid through the Ministry of Social Development, then I would be more than happy, Mr Speaker, to respond to those specific questions.
Question number 8, Jan Tonetti.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. To the Minister of Education, how are schools benefiting from the capital investment of the New Zealand Upgrade Program?
The Honourable Chris Hopkins.
Mr Speaker, around 2,050 state schools are eligible for up to $400,000 worth of capital investment based on their roll numbers to upgrade their classrooms and buildings. This is the largest capital injection for school upgrades in 25 years, and it's part of the government's $12 billion New Zealand Upgrade Program, which includes investments in roads, rails, hospitals and schools, and it will modernise our infrastructure and future-proof the economy. Schools no longer have to keep deferring modernising their classrooms and their property because they had to deal with more pressing and urgent repairs instead.
When will state schools start applying for funding for their property projects?
Mr. Speaker, the good news is they already have been. For example, Arahoe School in Auckland, who have already started the recladding of their classrooms. They've used some of the $400,000 that they were allocated to modernise five further classrooms they didn't have the money to do before. Riverdale School in Palmerston North did a similar thing, where they used the $285,000 they received as part of the New Zealand Upgrade Programme to add two more classrooms to their existing refurbishment programme.
Property projects in state schools have already had funding approved from the New Zealand Upgrade Programme.
Mr Speaker, I'm pleased to say that there are heaps, but I'll just cite a couple. For example, Rangiora Borough School, who wanted a new library, put it out to tender and found they didn't have enough money. They have now got that extra money and they are going ahead with their new library. Fairlie School in Canterbury was entitled to nearly $100,000 from the New Zealand Upgrade Programme, and by the end of last month, they'd already lined up a local building company to upgrade and modernise their classroom. And Murchison Area School got in there quickly too and used some of the $112,000 that they have been eligible for to refit their science lab with new benches, carpets and whiteboards. These are just some of the projects that are already underway around the country.
What actions is the government taking to encourage state schools to get their projects underway with funding from the New Zealand Upgrade Programme?
Mr Speaker, the Ministry of Education has already contacted every state school in the country about the funding that is available to them. Their property advisers have been working with them to look at their current property plans and look at what they can add to or accelerate from those programs. And we've already, in the first few weeks of term, seen an additional 91 schools identify the projects, and that rate is accelerating rapidly.
Question number 9, Jenny Markoff.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Regional Economic Development and asks, what recent Provincial Growth Fund announcements has he made?
The Honourable Shane Jones.
Mr Speaker, consistent with being the most historic pro-infrastructure government of the century, 47 PGF projects have been announced, over $200 million to aid the cause of expanding rail into an important province in New Zealand, aiding the cause of expanding water storage to deal with changing climate challenges both in Wairarapa and another important province in the nation, $30 million to work practically with Māori groups to unleash the potential of their land and avoid litigation which ensnared the last government in their poor relationship with Māoridom over water interests.
Supplementary, what other PGF announcements have been made this year?
Sir, I speak very briefly of the
chance
opening...
Of, chance would be a fine thing, but carry on.
So I speak very modestly of the opening of the Te Rau Aroha Whare Taonga Whakamaumahara, offering testimony to the ethic of service, otherwise known as the Māori Battalion Museum. The National Party MPs from the South Island have privately communicated to me over their joy with the Kai Koura announcement. They have asked that I not out them because they've been advised they're not allowed to speak publicly about such good news, although the mayors of those areas do. And $6.1 million for the Wairoa CBD build, including a $960,000 contribution to the Wairoa Digital Employment Program, which is, shows that this government works down at the level of the earthy interests of New Zealand society, not the big end of town which crippled the vision of the last government. Sir, I have also been advised that in the event further assistance is needed in projects in Nelson, under no circumstances associate them with Nick Smith.
Trent, and how have these announcements been received in the regions?
Briefly. Sir, great friends of mine, the Federated Farmers, their president, Mr William Beetham, has welcomed the Wairarapa water investment, noting some of our largest companies, sir, and employers are under threat going forward as they were failed in their ambitions in the previous 9 years. The Kia Kaha program, sir, effecting a relocation and the development of Northport has been supported by Dr. Retty and the occasionally seen Mr. Matt King.
The Right Honourable Winston Peters.
Many questions. Can the Minister report to the House as to how many times he's been knocked over by National Party MPs trying to get to the openings of these projects?
Order. I think we'll just leave that there. I think he's not responsible for being knocked over. Question number 10, Chris Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister of Transport, does he stand by his statement on 7 December 2017? But I want to make it clear that it is not the role of the Minister of Transport to prioritise particular roading projects and have any roading projects in the transport component of the New Zealand Upgrade Program been prioritised.
The Honourable Grant Robertson.
Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the Minister, yes, I stand by my statement in the context it was given. In answer to the second part of the question, all of the roading projects in the New Zealand Upgrade Program are a priority for this government. That's why we funded them.
Was the New Zealand Infrastructure Commission involved in the selection of the projects to prioritise, and if so, how?
Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the Minister, the main responsibility for the identification of projects was, as you would expect, with NZTA. As the Minister said in the House yesterday, he had conversations with the Minister of Finance around the projects. I would have to get back to the Minister on the exact role of the member, on the exact role of the Infrastructure Commission, but it would have been a minor advisory one if there were one.
When did Auckland Transport find out about the transport projects selected as part of the upgrade program?
Mr. Speaker, the member will have to put, on behalf of the Minister, the member will have to put that question down in writing to give him a specific time and date.
Why is the South Island receiving less than 5% of the nearly $7 billion committed to transport projects in the upgrade program?
On behalf of the Minister, the upgrade program represents additional spending on top of the already impressive rate of spending through the National Land Transport Fund, around $3.5 billion in the South Island. I know in the Canterbury community, where some concerns have been raised, $1.5 billion going there from the National Land Transport Fund. So these projects are in addition to what has already been done.
Did the government consider prioritising the East-West Link project in Auckland as part of the New Zealand upgrade, and when will the government announce a decision on that important project?
Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the Minister, that was not a project that was included in the considerations. Obviously, it remains a project on the books. The concern that the government have previously had, that this government has previously had, is that that was going to be per kilometre one of the most expensive roads in the world. That project obviously can be relooked at as time and resources allow.
Why should New Zealanders have any confidence in the ability of the government to actually deliver these projects when ministers in the government have spent years criticising the projects they say they are now prioritising?
Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the Minister, there is one very important reason why New Zealanders can have confidence in the projects in the New Zealand Upgrade Program. We've actually funded them.
Question number 11, Mayor Lubeck. And I just will say to the member that now we have one member from north of Auckland being, you know, relatively quiet, there's not a need for another one to replace him. Mayor Lubeck.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Building and Construction and asks, what recent information, if any, has she seen about a growing construction workforce?
The Honourable Jenny Solicitor.
Mr. Speaker, building the homes, schools, roads, rail and hospitals New Zealand needs requires a growing construction workforce. It's great, Mr. Speaker, that this coalition government's work together with industry is delivering a growing construction workforce. From the figures from MB and the Tertiary Education Commission, it shows that the building and construction workforce is growing larger and it's becoming more diverse. In fact, since we came in as coalition government 2 years ago, an additional 11,000 people have joined the construction sector. A huge increase, Mr. Speaker, and it's proof that our plan is working.
Supplementary. What government policies have helped with this increase?
Mr Speaker, we've achieved this record construction workforce by working with industry through the Construction Sector Accord as well as through the Construction Skills Action Plan. This includes making trades training fees free for the first 2 years, raising the standard of trades in our schools through the Prime Minister's Vocational Excellence Awards and prioritising apprenticeships through our new government procurement rules. This has meant construction apprentices has increased by 20% since 2017, with an additional 4,700 apprentices being trained at any one time.
Supplementary, how is the construction workforce growing more diverse?
Mr Speaker, we're recruiting more women, more Māori, more Pacific, as well as more Asian New Zealanders. In just 2 years, 1,000 more Māori have joined the construction industry. An additional 2,700 more women in construction, 600 more Pacific, and 2,800 more Asian New Zealanders working in construction. I'm proud of what we've achieved so far, and this government will keep delivering the workforce that our country needs.
Question number 12, Simon O'Connor.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. Questions to the Associate Minister of Housing, and asks, can he confirm that almost 14,500 New Zealanders are currently waiting for a state house and that the waiting list is more than double what it was when National left office?
Mr Speaker.
The Honourable Chris Hipkin.
Mr Speaker, on behalf of the Associate Minister, yes. The government has always been clear that it is going to take some time to reverse the damage that 9 years of neglect caused. 5,000 state houses were removed from the state housing list under the last government. Since we took office, we've created 4,258 new public housing spaces, and we have a further 3,480 houses under construction. If that rate of progress had been in place over the 9 years prior to when we became the government, we would not have a state house waiting list at all.
Can the minister once again confirm to the House that a large number of those new builds were actually started, consented or contracted by the former government?
Mr Speaker, some of those were at various stages under the previous government.
As would
have been the case when the previous government took office back in 2009. Had they sustained a rate of progress of building new houses during that time, we would not have a waiting list. Unfortunately, they took the view, espoused by Paula Bennett, that if the government sold state houses, other organisations like banks would step in and fill the void. It was that kind of befuddled thinking that created the mess that we have now.
The Honourable Stuart Nash.
Has the Minister seen reports that in the city of Napier, under the previous government, over 140 state houses and units were torn down and not one replaced?
Mr Speaker, yes, I can confirm that example. There are other examples. For example, in Trentham, where hundreds of state houses were demolished and replaced by the land being sold to private developers. So further state houses were not built in that. There are examples of that all over the country.
Is he able to confirm that if, is he able to confirm that if the numbers of people waiting for a state house is increasing and that the wait times for such houses is over 3.5 months, then by definition things are getting worse under this government?
Mr Speaker, the waiting lists are increasing. That is an unavoidable fact, and the fact is we do not have enough houses to accommodate those people. Our government is working as fast as we can to build additional houses. But what we will never do is what the last National government did when it purged people from the state house waiting list in order to try and create the impression that there wasn't a problem when there was.
Is the government proposing to make New Zealanders who are having to live in motels still pay 25% of their income towards it because the government is running out of money after a 440% increase in emergency housing expenditure?
Mr Speaker, no. It is because we don't want to create a situation where people in an emergency housing are better off financially than people who are actually paying rent in normal houses or in transitional houses.
And is it still the government's intention that, quote, no one should have to live in a car? And if so, why is the government including an exemption in their smoke-free environments bill for people who do live in cars?
Order. That's not an area the Minister's responsible for.
Good question, though.
Further supplementaries? No further supplementaries. That concludes oral questions.